When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Everybody, welcome to this week's episode of the Elise Glink Show. I'm your host, Elise Glink, and I am here to help you make smart decisions about your money. But first, Glinkonomics. So RealtyTrack released its Q2 2015 home equity and underwater report last week, and here are some of the most interesting stats. In Q2 2015, so March through June, 7.4 million U.S. residential properties were considered seriously underwater. By that, they generally mean more than 90 days late on payments. 13% of all properties with a mortgage in the second quarter. So that number is down, which is good. But Q2 2015 also saw a slight increase in the percentage of homes that were seriously underwater of 0.1%, 13.2% in Q1, and a decrease of 3.9% from Q2 2014. By comparison, a year ago, Q2 2014, 9.1 million properties were seriously underwater, or 17% of total properties with mortgages. So we are moving in the right direction. Major metropolitan statistical areas, that's with a population of 500,000 or more, with the highest percentage of residential properties seriously underwater, were Lakeland, Florida, at 28.5%. Imagine that, 28.5% of all homes in Lakeland, Florida are seriously underwater. Cleveland's not far behind, 28.2%. Las Vegas is almost 28%. Akron, Ohio is 27.3%. Orlando, Florida, 26.1%. Tampa, 24.8%. Chicago, 24.8%. Palm Bay, Florida, 24.5%. Toledo, Ohio, 24.3%. All of those metropolitan areas representing millions and millions of people are at least 0.25% underwater. Since RealtyTrack began tracking underwater data in 2013, Las Vegas and Lakeland, the MSAs around there, have been competing for the number one spot. This is absolutely not where you want to be number one. In highest percent of seriously underwater properties. And Q2 2013 was actually the worst quarter for Las Vegas, with 54.7%, almost 55% of properties seriously underwater. That number is just scary. So it's half of that now. Lakeland, Florida is showing that Q3 2013 was the worst quarter for them, with basically half of all properties being seriously underwater. So that was the worst of it. 2 years ago, or almost 2 years ago, and today it's dropped by about half. So what's happened there? In most of those areas, those properties have finally gone through the foreclosure process. If it was a judicial state, it took longer anyway. Those properties have gotten snapped up for pennies on the dollar, but having so many homes underwater at this point in the cycle, when we have seen such a rise in home values across the country, means it's unlikely that any of these properties is going to get out from underwater over the next 10 years. That makes them much more higher likely to default. I don't know if that's even proper English, but much more likely that they will default or have to do short sales. And as an investor, if you're an investor, that's a great opportunity for you. If you're a first-time homebuyer, it's another great opportunity for you. But in general, we are seeing the number of homes that are underwater drop significantly. And just to give you some sort of perspective, even if it's 13% underwater, it's a whole lot more than what it should be, which is about 2 to 4%. So we still have a whole ways to go for these MSAs, which again represent millions and millions and millions of homeowners. We have a ways to go until these MSAs start to bounce back, which just means that there are real concerns out there that the other national MSAs, or the other, I should say, regional MSAs, have sort of gotten overblown. And we're going to have to see whether there's kind of a pullback in prices, as some economists are starting to suggest there could be. And certainly if there's any bump economically, we're going to see a pullback in home prices and what this means for the homes that are already underwater in these 10 areas. So let's talk about interest rates for a moment, because after heading higher, suddenly everything turned around. Later this week, the Federal Reserve Bank is going to hold its open markets meeting. It does that about every 6 weeks. And this is where the Fed says, yep, interest rates are going up or they're not going up, and they try to give some guidance. And Janet Yellen has been both criticized and applauded for frank talk and what she really means, and to try and be more transparent and less, opaque. But it's a little unclear about what's going to happen. No change to current interest rate policies due or expected. So what's been happening over the last couple of years is the Fed has started to unwind its massive bond buying policies. And we were seeing the Fed buy $80 billion of mortgage-backed securities at the height of the recession, and that continued on for a really long time. You had Q1, Q2, Q3. They just stopped numbering them after a while. But now they're buying less and less and less. And so that's supposed to completely stop sometime later this year. Maybe it's close to stopping now. We don't know. You always know in arrears with the Fed. But the other thing that's going to happen is the Fed is then going to start raising interest rates. And some of the Fed presidents have called for short-term interest rates to rise as early as September, right? September. So we're going to have to look for subtle changes in the language the Fed uses, see what happens. Many of the Fed officials are hinting that this is going to happen, and or have even outright said that the Fed is going to raise interest rates. If they raise interest rates, that means interest rates are going up for everybody else. The more interesting thing is that Greece has actually decided to stay in the EU and retain the euro. So for the moment, despite the fact that there was actually a plan for a real Grexit, and it's not just a John Stewart thing, a real Grexit that the country walked back from, there is still the matter of how much money Greece and the other countries in the EU that are in seriously bad shape, how the EU is going to bail them out, what they're going to do about all this debt, and who's going to forgive what portion of it. And with an increased risk of never paying back at least some of that debt comes higher interest rates, which is why the U.S. looks like a safer bet to park cash. Hello, that just means interest rates are going to go down here, because it would be really hard for the Fed to raise interest rates when interest rates are negative in the EU right now. You put $100 into some banks in Europe and you get back 97 or 98 bucks. You put $100 in a U.S. bank, you're going to get back 100 and maybe 50 cents. So what would you rather do? Make almost no money or lose money, right? So we're going to see how this all plays out. As far as the stock market goes, watch for earnings and what's going on in China. If earnings continue to wobble, Amazon's results aside, surprise, surprise, you might see a bigger reaction to the eventual rise in interest rates. Over in China, where we saw earlier this week that the stock market dropped 8.5%, last Monday, which was the worst move for China's stock market in maybe like 8 or 9 years. And you're also seeing the Chinese government try to prop it up, and that's seemingly not working. That could have a profound effect on what goes on in the U.S. as well. The best thing to do is this. If you're going to buy a home or borrow funds for another investment or refinance your mortgage, just go ahead and do it. There is no sense in waiting around. Eventually, interest rates will rise. Final note. It's kind of not really a Glinkonomics thing, but it sort of is. A few weeks ago, I told you that my husband Sam and I were looking to buy a building. It's a commercial property with around 20,000 square feet. And the building is older, not code compliant. It has an awesome ceiling, which basically means it's going to need a bunch of work, and we're going to have to figure out new uses for it. Oh, and let me just say the taxes are like way out of whack given what the value of the property is. But that's the opportunity. So we've spent the last couple of weeks meeting with architects and village officials and prospective tenants, all trying to decide whether this is a good investment and what we'd have to pay for it in order to make one. The big takeaway so far for me for a commercial property is this. It's about putting all the jigsaw pieces together. It's very different from buying a single family home and renting it out. So I have a huge spreadsheet of costs, scenarios, and other items that's 4 pages deep. And we've already spent maybe 20 to 30 hours on the deal. And we haven't even fully figured it out yet. But we're getting more comfortable with it, and I feel like I'm almost ready to make an offer. Buying investment real estate, any way you put it, huge amount of work. And if you don't want to put in the work, you shouldn't be doing it. because that's how you keep it from being a big gamble. I mean, you want to gamble, go to Vegas. You want to actually buy an investment, you got to put in the work for it. So Sam and I have a couple of make or break meetings lined up in the next couple of weeks. Stay tuned. I'll let you know if and when we decide to make an offer. All right, now for the rest of the Elise Glink Show. My guest today is Carl Shepard. He's the co-founder and chief development officer for online vacation rental platform HomeAway. HomeAway experienced swift growth since its founding a decade ago. It's become the leading online marketplace for listings and finding vacation rental properties. They own all the big names. So I invited Carl to come on the show and talk about how HomeAway managed such a feat in such a short period of time. It is a multi-billion dollar market, and whether you're currently a vacation property owner, plan to invest in a vacation rental property in the future, or are just looking for an easier way to find a place to stay during your next vacation, you will not want to miss this segment. Then I've got a two-part report on some of the considerations that first-time home buyers, and more specifically first-time mortgage borrowers, need to keep in mind when preparing to apply for the first loan. In part one, I'll offer my tips on how to find a good lender in your area. In part two, I've got some advice on how to give yourself the best chance of getting your loan application approved with minimal hassles. Anyone who hasn't applied for a mortgage but plans to do so in the future should get a lot out of these segments, so stay tuned. Okay, that's the lineup for today's show. Let's get started. So we're well into the summer, which means lots of people are taking vacation. And while some people enjoy vacationing at home, staycations, right? That's very popular during the Great Recession, and prefer to avoid the super busy travel season, many of you, particularly if you have kids, are going to set out by plane, train, or automobile for a destination vacation. And if you're not staying at a hotel or in a tent, you're probably headed to some sort of vacation rental property. My guest today knows a thing or two about the vacation rental market. Carl Shepard is the co-founder and chief development officer of the Austin, Texas-based HomeAway, Inc., which has quickly grown to become the leading online marketplace for vacation rentals in the world. Today, just 10 years after its founding, I can hardly believe it's been 10 years, HomeAway has over a million vacation rental properties listed on its various websites spanning 190 countries. Carl, welcome to Big Money Real Estate.
Thank you, Lisa. Happy to be here.
So give me a little sense of how you decided that this was a market that needed tackling.
Oh, gosh. Well, you have to go back 10 years ago, and I'd love to go back 10 years ago at my age. But
yeah, me too.
when we first started, when Brian Sharples and I first met 10 years ago, we discussed that one of the things that we had in common was we loved traveling using vacation rentals and just how hard it was. So basically, HomeAway was formed out of something, a need that we found in the marketplace that to make it just as easy to book a vacation rental as was to, at the time, to book a hotel. And it was a very straightforward business choice on our part to say, gee, we think there's a large market there, and we're going to go after it.
So you've raised in 10 years $405 million in private funding. You've acquired 17 websites. There's now 2,000 employees, 18 offices, $447 million in revenue last year, and that was up almost 30% from 2013. That is quite a growth trajectory in just 10 short years.
Yeah, we're proud of that. I think that's a testament that we had the right idea at the right time. And why I'd love to say that we were the only people that could have made this happen, the reality was is that when you came in 2005, you were just coming out of those doldrum years of the dot-com bust. And what we were able to do when we put HomeAway together was just be in front of the tidal wave that was coming. Where the largest trend in travel for the last 10 years has been the trend towards families and groups traveling together using vacation homes as their primary outlet.
So I have totally can see that. I mean, I've done that with my husband's extended family. We rented a house in Acapulco a number of years ago. We've rented other kinds of properties. We're always looking. We always talk about the Palazzo in Italy we're going to be renting. And I think a lot of other people are dreaming in that direction as well. But to your point about competitors, you did acquire 17 websites. There were a whole lot of other companies doing this, and you just kind of raised enough money to group it in mass. Looking back, is there something else you wish you had done?
Oh, I think that what we did when we first started the business was we were going to just be a competitor. And everything changed when VRBO came up for sale. If VRBO had not come up for sale, we probably would have had a slightly different strategy with HomeAway. But as it was, when VRBO was available, we brought it into the fold, and we discovered that all of the brands that we had developed and acquired over time had equity in their home markets. Abritel is very big in France. Fable Direct is very big in Germany. And VRBO was the largest in the United States. So the notion of trying to consolidate that under all of one brand name was thought about for a while. Then we said, no, we want to serve the travelers who understand us and the owners who have fallen in love with their providers. And we just want to grow from there. So I think if I had to do it and go back in any way, no, I think that HomeAway has, there's always things that we could have improved, but I think that we've proven that we have created a lot of value, and our shareholders are pretty happy with us.
So one of the things that's pretty interesting is that you said that in your numbers that you've released, $12 billion with a B, I want to be really clear to everybody watching at home, $12 billion was generated by HomeAway customers in 2014. More than half of the owners who work with you on all of your websites generate enough rental income to cover at least three-quarters of their mortgage payment. Tell me about that. That just seems like a remarkable number. It's not the full mortgage payment, but they're covering three-quarters of it. Are these homeowners who are using those homes and the rest of the time, you know, how are they making the rest of the payments? And $12 billion is a significant amount of money. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, the $12 billion really comes from just the sheer size of the travel industry in general. And then in our owners, we are representing that much inventory. That much economic benefit is driven through the pages of HomeAway properties. We have 60 million travelers a month who are coming to one of our properties around the world. They're booking an average of 5.5 days. They're paying an average of $1,500 a week. So when you take all of that, you can begin to get to that $12 billion number pretty easily. That's real economic activity for those owners that helps them to offset the cost of ownership of the home. I think one of the core things that when you're understanding the vacation rental industry is that most suppliers, if you want to use the word supplier for owners, are people who want to own a vacation home. They actually want to own that place at Beaver Creek in Colorado. They want to have the beach condo in Destin, Florida, and it's important for their families. This is a significant asset that they're buying, and they are. It means a great deal in their family economics and their family financial future. So they want to take control of how that asset is monetized, if it's going to be monetized. And at HomeAway, we talk about internally. Sometimes we talk about the life cycle of vacation home. You buy that vacation home, the kids are little, you're in your late 30s, early 40s, you're going there every weekend, you're driving down to that beach from Atlanta, Georgia to Destin, you're going from Austin to Port Aransas, and then the kids 2 years later, they start soccer and they can't really go on the weekends, and you wake up one day in the second or third year of ownership of a home and realize you're just not using it as frequently as you used to. And that's been the traditional vacation rental owner. What's happened in the last 10 years, at least now that we are surfacing this industry, and you really didn't see this industry to the size that it is until HomeAway came about. And what's happened is we've now attracted people who are going to say, wait, this is also an investment. So I want to not only pick a vacation home, I want to pick one in a market destination where the rental income can be significant, because I do want to pay that mortgage with some of these dollars. I want to use my house, but I want to pay that mortgage with it. So over the last 10 years, I can see a trend towards even for younger people buying their second home first. If you live in San Francisco, for example, real estate for your primary home is probably off the table for you if you're just making less than a couple hundred thousand dollars a year. But you can buy that second home in Big Sur or up on the Northern California coast, and you can begin building equity and build your financial future as well. So I think the market is changing as people become aware of, hey, this is a way I can actually build wealth.
I agree. I think the market is changing. I'm wondering, are you worried about and talking about surfacing ambitions, are you worried about Airbnb and other kinds of competitive sites that are taking the weekly or even 4 days a week rental and they're moving it to not really quite an hourly market yet, but they're moving it and making it very easy to rent something just for the day?
Yeah, I think that most vacation homeowners on HomeAway aren't going to rent for a day or a couple of days. It's just not worth it to them to open the house up and close the house back down for a couple of days. And you have to contrast that to our competitor, Airbnb, which has really tapped into a completely different segment of the market. 95% or more of the homes on Airbnb are one-bedroom apartments that are rented apartments. There's no equity in those homes. The tenant is subletting his apartment, if you follow me. So that's just driving different economics for that owner, that supplier. They really can rent for a night, because if they don't rent for a night, they still pay their rent that month, right?
Right.
So the notion is just that it's offering more choice to travelers, which is good. But I think it's a very different choice to stay in somebody's primary home. It's just kind of, I personally think it's weird when I stay in somebody's primary home to see their underwear in the drawer. I much prefer a home.
Wait a second. Did you just admit to looking in somebody's drawers? Wait a second.
Listen, you have to put your stuff somewhere. You're staying someplace for 5 days. You're not going to use the drawers.
Right.
So it's just a different side of the market. But the good thing about Airbnb is that it does open up this experience of staying in something other than a home hotel, which is good for the vacation rental industry and therefore good for HomeAway.
So let me move on to some other things. We talked a little bit about profitability and this idea of tapping into the equity that you have. And you don't mean like mortgage equity the way a lot of people do. You just mean the equity of or the value that their home actually holds. There's a cost against that. And this is allowing people to tap in. How can investors, real estate investors, make these vacation rentals even more profitable than they already are?
Oh, I think that you have to really be a very savvy investor in real estate and travel. You have to really, those two Venn diagrams have to intersect. You need to be an expert in real estate and an expert in travel if you're going to be investing for the purposes of cash flow in vacation rentals. I have a vacation rental personally in Port Aransas, Texas. That Port Aransas is not one of my favorite places in the world, but it is a huge destination market within Texas. And that property is extremely profitable. It more than covers all of its expenses. And if I had a mortgage on it, it would more than cover the mortgage. That's going to be different than a different place. Let's say I also would love to have personally a place in the hill country outside of Austin, Texas. Mm-hmm. But there's just not as much demand. I doubt that you could make a vacation rental purchase work and cash flow in a low demand market, although you can offset the cost. So real estate people who are looking to invest and profit in two ways, one from the cash flow from the current short-term rentals and from the long-term appreciation, would be best to make sure they intersect traveler demand with the placement of their investments.
I actually think that sites like yours and even Airbnb are really great resources for that. You know, you have to look and see what people are asking for, what they're getting for these properties, and then multiply that out. I think basic math skills are very helpful when it comes to investing in real estate. What is the biggest mistake that you think people are now making with their rental properties? Are they just not doing the math?
I think that if you're coming to we're not seeing a lot of people telling us they're making mistakes. We're still in the golden age where, Arthur Frommer has noted that for the last 8 years, vacation rental travel is the growth area in travel. So high growth covers a lot of mistakes, Elise.
Mm-hmm.
I think people who are in this for the long term really need to be being much more savvy about, is the place I'm investing in going to give me great appreciation? You know, I tell people all the time in our, I also supervise our government relations function here at HomeAway, and you'll see a lot of battles about regulations going on in places like San Francisco, and they talk about affordable housing, and this is going to be used to illustrate your point. There is no economic model, I can tell you, that's going to say you can buy a home in San Francisco where the average price is $1.5 to $1.7 million, renting that house for $400 a night for 20 weeks a year, which is the kind of would be a high end, that math just doesn't work.
Yeah, it doesn't work.
If you're going to invest in real estate using short-term rentals, you really need to be very crisp about what your long-term goal is. And if it's to offset your cost and to cover your cost, and you're therefore going for the long-term appreciation, that's a real estate strategy, right? But if you are looking to actually have significant cash flow off of this, where that property is, the demand for that property, HomeWay can help you with all of these things as you're looking and doing investigation. You're totally right that we can be used in that way for people to understand what that is. The final factor is, what is demand? And you can get demand statistics from your local convention and visitor bureau before you invest, just to make sure you've got sufficient demand to drive the economic model you're trying to create.
You know, it's interesting. For the real estate properties that my husband and I own, it's been interesting where we've kind of held them for a really long time. We have a one bedroom in downtown Chicago that's rented for 2-3 years at a time, along with a parking space that commands like $200 a month, which is pretty awesome. But the idea of long-term investments, I think people sometimes don't understand what that means anymore. There's this, we've all become so, 8 minutes and where's the commercial break on TV kind of people, or even for this new generation, instantaneous, access to everything. That this idea of waiting, and in our case for this one property, 14 years, we've now had it, or 15 years, 16 years, it's a really long time, and the property has now become very valuable, easily rentable, the market has grown up around it. There is some value to sort of buying and holding, right?
Oh, absolutely. I own a lot of personal real estate myself, and it's because my wife says that I'm a house junkie.
I know the feeling.
she catches me at night watching HGTV, and she says, "Are you watching house porn?" But yes, I'm very much into housing and real estate as an investment. And I think that you're exactly right, but I think that's something you see with the hindsight of some experience. I think it's very difficult for people right now. I have great faith in our millennial generation. We at HomeAway, I am the old fart at HomeAway. I'm the old man. And everybody else around here is in the average age is in the early 30s. Mm-hmm. And those young people are beginning to look at homes, and they're beginning to look at real estate.
Yeah.
And I think they will be able to see those trends. But it's hard when your first house, is going to cost you a lot more than our first house cost my wife and I. But the economic model is still the same. Real estate that's well-placed, like your home in Chicago, like the houses we own here in Austin, is a great investment. And then you need to make the choice, if you're going to be working in the vacation rental industry, is to, will I be better off with a long-term renter or a short-term renter? Because the long-term renter is going to be more stable, sit it and forget it sort of thing. The short-term rental is work. You need to have a fully furnished apartment. It needs to be beautiful, by the way. It needs to, to really attract that top dollar, it needs to be a pretty high-end property. You need to, if it's a freestanding home, you're going to have to take care of the yard yourself. You're going to have to take care of the pool yourself, or have that done. So you need to look at these things and say, which is the best long-term strategy for holding real estate? And my personal belief is that short-term rentals in cities that are forward enough thinking cities to see how beneficial this is to their local economy are going to be great investments for people. But cities like San Francisco, New York, Chicago even, where the real estate has far, cost per real estate has far outstripped what rental people, you can charge long-term rental, are not going to be necessarily great markets for investing in short-term rentals. If you have property there, dude, they are great markets for short-term rentals if you already own the property.
It's fantastic. Carl, thank you so much for being with us today. That's just terrific advice.
Well, I'm happy to do it, and I hope you'll think of us again sometime, Elise.
We always do. Carl Shepard is the co-founder and chief development officer for HomeAway, Inc. You're searching for your first home. You're also searching for your first mortgage lender. Now, I don't make specific recommendations on lenders because it's way too tough to stay up to date on the many thousands of lenders who work in the U.S., but I can give you some very useful tips for how to approach your search for a lender. When you're looking for a mortgage lender, you want to start off by talking to a mortgage broker who has a good reputation in your area. You should also, at the same time, talk to a regional lender, a credit union if you belong to one or you can join one, and a small local bank. Each of these different types of lenders will offer different loan programs at different prices. You should also ask friends and relatives who they've used for their home loans and how the experience went. But emphasis is on the experience. I have a great friend who once asked her sister for a lender recommendation, and the sister gave her a name, and my friend had this horrific experience. And when she went back to her sister to see what kind of experience her sister had had with this person, her sister confirmed that she too had a horrific experience. "Hello, why did you give me that lender's name?" my friend asked, and the sister said, "Well, you weren't specific that you wanted someone good." It sounds like a Seinfeld episode, right? And yet, this kind of stuff goes on all the time. So here are some questions you should ask the person providing the recommendation that will help separate the wheat from the chaff. Did the lender repeatedly ask for the same documents? Is the lender organized? A good lender should enable you to close on a home within about 45 days, unless there are some real serious problems with the house. So make sure to ask your friends and relatives if their lenders were able to meet that standard. It may sound obvious, but it's a really good idea to look for a lender who specializes in making residential loans and has a reputation in your area for coming through with these loans. Banks that aren't generally known for their mortgage lending can be tougher to work with than some of the really big lenders. And while you may be thinking to yourself, "I want to avoid the big banks," you're probably going to end up with one anyway. Even if you go with a mortgage broker, that mortgage broker may actually work with a whole bunch of big lenders to fund your loan. Above all, you need to find a lender that helps you understand the mortgage application process in a way that makes you feel comfortable and secure. This is a huge decision. You're going to finance this property for the long run, and you want to do that with the right kind of partner. And I just want to give a shout out to anybody who is closing around October of 2015. If you are, please watch the videos that I've made on the TILA RESPA changes that are coming your way. Right now, they're scheduled to go into effect October 3rd of 2015. If you are looking to close around that, either before or after, you may have to build in some extra time to make sure that you don't get caught up in all the craziness that's going to go on, I think, when TILA RESPA actually goes into effect. I offered my best advice for first-time homebuyers on how to find a good mortgage lender. But before applying, even for that first loan, it's critical that you take a few steps beyond saving up for a down payment to ensure that your application has the best chance of getting approved. Before submitting your mortgage application, you're going to want to pull a copy of your credit history from at least one of the three major credit reporting bureaus. You can go to annualcreditreport.com and get a free copy from each of the credit reporting bureaus at least once a year. So start there. It may help you get an idea of some of the things you're going to have to work on before you can even apply for your loan. Make sure you're current on all of your payments to your credit cards and that there are no errors that need to be fixed. If you see that you've made one late payment in the last year, you'll probably need to deliver a letter to the lender that explains why you were even late on that payment. If you received a sizable deposit in any of your checking or savings accounts, you're going to need to tell the lender why you had such a deposit that was out of the ordinary. Even a large deposit into your account from the IRS might require an explanation. The lender wants to make sure that any money used for the purchase of your home has aged for some time in your account. And by that, I mean it has sort of sat there without being used month in and month out, usually several months. 3 to 6 is a good amount of time. Now, first-time homebuyer programs are a little tough to find these days. But you can talk to your local housing authority and use an online search engine to search terms like first-time homebuyer program in the name of your city. That's the fastest way to find out information about what programs exist and whether you qualify. You can also go to down payment programs, put quotes around that in Google as well, and that should pop up some interesting programs for your neighborhood. Of course, you can also pick up a copy of my book, 100 Questions Every First-Time Homebuyer Should Ask. That book is still available at most major bookstores and at Amazon.com. I hope you enjoyed today's episode, and I specifically want to thank my guest, Carl Shepherd from HomeAway, for being on the show. Thank you, Carl. So if there was anything you missed, don't worry. We've got all the show notes to this episode at thinklink.com, thinkglink.com. If you're new to the show, please subscribe. If you're a regular listener and haven't already done so, please consider giving the show a rating or review on iTunes. You can do that by searching for The Elise Glink Show in the podcast section of iTunes, and this will help our show get discovered by lots of new people. Also, while you're doing that, take a listen to Monday Morning Marketing with Elise Glink and John Byrne. You can also find it by Googling my name along with Monday Morning Marketing in quotes at iTunes. And again, be sure to give the show a rating or review. It's for anyone who wants some extra marketing, PR, and social media advice. John's an award-winning former chief marketing officer for a global law firm and an attorney. And as you all know, I run a digital content agency, ThinkLink Media. You can find us online at thinklinkmedia.com. All right, folks, that's the end of another episode of The Elise Glink Show. I'm still your host, Elise Glink, and I'll be back next week with another new episode. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great week.